Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, our conversations cover the need for justice in the form of an economics and war crimes tribunal in Liberia. Here's a vivid example of a killing that happened in front of a woman and her children right inside their home.
The killings that went on happened to me in my house. So it was not that bullets are flying and straight bullet hit you. No. Somebody just come into your home and say, hey, you, and they start cutting off the person passed while the children of the person is there.
The person she was talking about was her husband, being killed right in front of their children. A warning to the government of Cameroon should food and fuel prices continue to rise.
The government should be prepared to see retaliation from the citizens at different stages, either social unrest, so many citizens will decide that Cameroon is not affordable for them and they will have to emigrate or get out of the country.
And how women-led healthcare providers are filling a gap in the market for healthcare products for women. It's Monday, the 4th of March. First, we go to Liberia. It's a small country that contains multitudes. It's the oldest independent republic in Africa, founded by freed enslaved people from America. It gave our continent the first elected woman president in the person of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The man who preceded her, Charles Taylor, is the first African president to be tried and convicted for war crimes. He's currently serving a life sentence here in the United Kingdom. But not for crimes committed during Liberia's two civil wars, the first between 1989 and 1997, and then again in 1999 and 2003. Charles Taylor was prosecuted for war crimes his militia committed in neighboring Sierra Leone's concurrent civil war. And it is this issue that brings us to our first story today. During the first Liberian civil war, it is estimated that 200,000 people were killed. In the second, a reported 50,000 people were killed and tens of thousands of others were internally displaced. Many thousands were raped, mutilated, and tortured in both those wars. This mother of two watched in horror as her husband was hacked to death in front of her and their children.
The killings that went on happened to me in my house, inside the house with us. So those people that participated in it, I know them very, very well. It was not that bullets are flying and a stray bullet hit you or you got caught up in a cross combat. No. If something happened that somebody just come into your home and say, hey, you are this and you are that, and in your person they start manipulating and they start cutting off, you know, the person pass and why the children of the person is there.
Several Liberians have been prosecuted for war crimes committed inside the country, but no one has been prosecuted in Liberia. In fact, there is no structure set up to do that, even though Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommended that one be set up. So why hasn't this happened? We spoke to Jerome Verdier, who was selected to serve as the chairman of the TRC.
It is not just a war crimes code. It is the war and economic crimes code that we are advocating. So it's just a question of interest. People are concerned about their personal interests, and that's the reason why they haven't supported the code. On one hand, there are some who said, forget about economic crimes, and let's focus on war crimes. And then we will support the war crimes code. And then we say, no, it has to be both. And on the other hand, there are a group of them who said, let's focus on economic crimes because it has led to the impoverishment of the country. It has led to the destruction of the economy and forget about war crimes. War crimes is in the past. Then we said, no, both reinforces the other. There were war in the country because of the economic situation and massive exploitation of the resources. And the last leaders didn't do, but we are hopeful that the current leader will give some attention, and he has made some commitment that he will address the issue of the war crimes court.
What does post-conflict Liberia stand to gain from a war and economics crimes court? It's 20 years since the war ended.
We have to demonstrate publicly that impunity is not the way to go, and justice is the way to go. It's the new direction for our country. But impunity is very pervasive in Liberia. People believe they can take the law into their own hands. People have no respect for the rule of law. There is disrespect for the law all over, all levels of society. Corruption is so pervasive in society. And these are the attitudes that have to be changed, if I can count that as the most significant reason why we need a court, not only for justice, but to ensure that there is a culture of adherence to the rule of law and accountability.
But Liberia is a small country, and doesn't a court dig up old wounds and undermine the uneasy but maybe growing sense of security and reconciliation that people have right now?
True, Liberia is a small country, but Liberia is a very rich country. And on the other hand, Liberia is also a very poor country. Since the TRC, Liberians have come to reckon with the war and the consequences of the war. There are no old wounds to open that will spur conflict. Everybody knows who the perpetrators are. Everybody knows why there was a war in Liberia. Everybody knows who the victims are. Everybody have gotten to appreciate the need for justice and accountability, because they know it was impunity that drove the conflict. And if the issue of impunity and justice is not redressed, the likelihood of a recurrence in the future is very, very high.
So we had Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, we had George Weah, now we have Joseph Boakai. What makes you confident that he would be willing to set up a war crimes tribunal?
Of all the three leaders you mentioned, President Boakai stands out. One, he is the most senior statesman in Liberia. But that credibility he brings to office a period of public service in which he distinguished himself as a man of integrity. There is nothing about corruption that can be ascribed to him, his conduct, or his performance in government. And he has demonstrated that he is a man of his word. He campaigned on the establishment of the War and Economic Crimes Court. An entire nation is holding him to that. The international community is holding him to that. And besides, that was the most significant campaign agenda, I think, that rallied all the country around him. Despite Mr. Weah's being a populist leader, President Boakai still emerged. So I'm a man of faith. I trust God, that God would do it for Liberia. And I believe in President Boakai. I remember when he was asked that upon becoming president, will you implement the War on Economic Crimes Code? He raised his right hand and he said, so help me God. To me, that was an expression of faith that he's committing to God and to man that he would do it.
But his vice president, Jeremiah Kung, was very close to Prince Johnson. He's one of the people that Liberians blame for the civil war.
Vice President Kung is his own man. And the issues of Prince Johnson is very minor compared to the issues of an entire nation. That is just one man, one perpetrator, compared to the interests and the future of 5 million people. I think President Kung has realized he's a sound man. I've listened to him. I followed him during the campaign. When Prince Johnson was making decisions to support George Weah, President Kung was making decisions to support the United Party because he didn't believe that George Weah was competent enough to be president of Liberia. So he's his own man, and I believe he has the mandate of even his Nima people to support the War Economic Crimes Court.
Do you feel secure that if you succeed in pushing and getting a War and Economic Crimes Tribunal going in Liberia, that it would be safe for people to pursue it to the nth degree?
Definitely, without a doubt. it will be secure. Anybody resisting the establishment of the War and Economic Crimes Court have no cause to do that, except one person today, just to save their own skin. And beyond that, anybody who does not believe in justice, does not believe in democracy, does not believe in peace. I don't know of any country that have pursued justice and didn't benefit from it. The rule of law is a standard for development and for progress in society. So all Liberians are supportive of this exercise, and it's just an appeal to those who are still in doubt as to whether it's going to yield something fruitful to reconsider it and know that it's the interest of an entire nation as compared to the interest of just a segment of one person. And it's a good thing for every good modern society. Justice becomes a standard, there will be equal rights. Justice becomes the standard, there will be equal opportunity for all. Justice is the standard in Liberia. Corruption will be a thing of the past, and impunity will also be a thing of the past.
Well, from your mouth to Lady Justice's ears, Jerome, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. Let us know when you're back in Liberia.
Definitely.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That's Jerome Verdier, the lawyer and human rights activist and chairman of the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You probably don't need me to tell you that prices at the supermarkets, in the markets, and at the gas station have gone up recently. In Nigeria, the crisis is such that people are attacking government food stores, so much so they've had to increase security at food depots and food trucks. Millions more people face penury as costs climb with no end in sight. Cameroon is going through the same spike in food and fuel prices. It's happening across the continent and indeed in many parts of the world, including here in the UK. Cameroon is among the top 10 most expensive countries to live in on the continent, according to data sourced online. Let's hear from people living there who are feeling the pinch.
But this, my family, I did suffer because you don't get rent.
My family is suffering. Whenever the landlord comes asking for rent, we can't afford to pay.
They know they think the wrong deal for market.
When we got here, we could buy food with small amounts of money. But now the products have become so expensive in the market. Traders told us it's because their transporters complain that fuel prices have also increased.
The money that used to come and feed the family with, say, come and feed.
The money we used to feed the family now goes to fuel the car.
We are just managing.
We pray that the government gives us something so we are able to cope. At the moment, it's very difficult for us.
Dr. Kennedy Tumenta is an economic and business advisor in Cameroon. He issued this warning to the authorities should the situation continue.
If the government continuously accepts the pressure from the IMF without looking at the impact of such pressure on the citizen itself, the government should be prepared to see retaliation from the citizens at different stages. Either social unrest, or many citizens will decide that Cameroon is not affordable for them and they will have to emigrate or get out of the country.
Paul Njie is our correspondent in Cameroon. So start by telling us, Paul, what it's like for Cameroonians at the moment in terms of the cost of living. We know that in other parts of the continent, it's gone up dramatically. Other parts of the world, it's gone up dramatically as well, and people are really struggling.
Well, Audrey, the situation is really, really serious. Food prices have gone up, and also we are seeing a 15% increase in the price of fuel. People are criticizing, you know, authorities for the situation, but government is saying it's doing its best. As a matter of fact, in 2023, inflation was at about 7.2%. And now people are having to deal with all these rising costs in food and fuel at a time when, you know, there are other areas in the country reeling from armed conflicts and the impact. People say it's way too much for them to deal with at this time.
You know, in some countries, it's very specific conditions. What are the very specific things in Cameroon? I know the conflict, for instance, but how does that contribute to high prices?
because according to the National Institute of Statistics, reduced domestic production and also national and international security challenges that are disrupting food supply, these account for, you know, the rising costs of food prices. But also you spoke about the security situation in the northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon, of course, which has left so many people in dire economic context now. You know, every Monday in the English-speaking regions of the country is considered as a ghost town, which means that economic activities are grounded. And so if you're an ordinary taxi driver or a commercial, a business trader in Bamenda or in Boya or wherever in these two regions, you're not allowed to operate your business on Monday. And this now means that you don't make money on Monday. And this is the reality of so many people there. Added to the rising cost of living, people are asking the question, how do we survive, Audrey? So it's a whole mix of two crises in these regions.
Why are people not allowed to conduct business on a Monday in the Northwest and the Southwest?
It's based on a separatist order. The armed separatists for close to 7 years now have imposed what they call a ghost town on the English-speaking regions to, you know, act as a form of rebellion against authorities. And that's their own way to impose their dominance in these two regions. And so once they do that, you'd see people closing their shops, taxi drivers parking their vehicles, not operating. It is true that there's some sort of normality that is being witnessed as time goes on, but there are still a good number of people who respect these orders. And if you ask them, they'll tell you how much that impacts them in the long run.
Now, we know that in the Northwest and the Southwest, there's the war going on. So that would account for a very specific regional reason why prices are higher. But are there high prices across the country, and are they the same? So does a loaf of bread cost the same in the Northwest and the Southwest as it would elsewhere?
It's actually the same across the country, but then in the areas where there are conflicts, the situation would be different. But in terms of the reasons, like the National Institute of Statistics is saying, that there's reduced domestic production. And of course, poor weather conditions is hampering the production of food. Cameroon is also trying, you know, to make sure that things become stable again. But many people say that does not translate to a better economic meaning for their pockets.
What's the average salary in Cameroon?
Most employers do not actually respect the minimum wage which government, you know, has put in place, which would mean that there are several people in the country who are unable to keep up with their daily expenses because of the fact that what they make at the end of the month, it cannot keep them the whole month.
And what about things like rent and fuel and, you know, electricity, all of those things? Are they also quite high?
Cameroon as well, like I mentioned earlier, is currently witnessing a 15% increase in the price of fuel off the top of another 15% increase last year. Which means that people are having to pay double what they used to pay in 2022. And so people are wondering how long this is supposed to go. But perhaps it's also important to stress that this comes from a recent fuel subsidy cut by which authorities put in place since last year. In February this year, there was another subsidy, and that led to the increase in the price of fuel, which people are seeing. And also people are also complaining about, you know, high electricity costs and water. It's basically people are trying to survive. That's what they are saying.
And if they don't have enough money to keep body and soul together, what happens?
And that's the million-dollar question, Audrey, because, you know, some people would see themselves having, you know, health challenges which they will not be able to attend to. Some people might get into debt because they'll have to borrow to keep up with the expenses. And at the end of the day, you'd only have to wonder where they'll get the money to pay back. Prices are going up. We don't know for how long they'll continue going up. People are just in uncertain situations.
Are there government initiatives to actually try and help people cope? You know, we've seen in some countries, in Nigeria, for instance, attempts being made to try and help people cope. Is there any sense of that in Cameroon, subsidizing maybe the price of bread, you know, things like those?
Yeah, so what government has done is it has increased the salary of civil servants by 5%. It did same last year when the price of fuel went up by 15%. And it has also negotiated with the private sector to increase the minimum wage to about $70. It used to be about $60 last year. But people are saying that this still isn't enough to keep them going, because when they look at the cost which they have to, the costs which they have to bear, they see that it is not going to be enough for them to keep up.
One of the effects of people struggling to survive is that young people leave the country, whether they do that by taking their skills and leaving, you know, through legitimate means, or they risk their lives through undocumented routes, you know, dangerous routes. What's happening in Cameroon? Are people doing that?
Audrey, people are doing that. If you ask young people who perhaps don't have a job here, what's your plan? They'd say, I want to travel out. That's what many people are saying. And the situation is so concerning that even the president of the republic is talking about it. During his recent speech to young people on the 10th of February, he addressed the issue and said that young people should stay in the country. They should not always have, have the idea to want to leave the country. And according to him, Cameroon is an area where investors have prospects of coming in, and saying Cameroon investors are coming into the country. But the young people are not seeing things from the president's prism, you know. They are saying that from our end of things, we are not seeing the country, we are not seeing the economic prospects, we are not seeing it as a place where we can, you know, thrive, where our children can grow up to make proper ends meet for themselves and their own children. Young people are saying that, I want to travel out, that's the term now. And one of the juiciest destinations for now is Canada, I would say.
This is legal and through undocumented ways.
Yeah. So several people, depending on their level of frustration, they take different means to leave. For those who have the means, they go through the legal way. But for those who don't, they are forced to go through clandestine methods to get to wherever they feel is ideal, or a land where it is good enough for their greener pasture. So it's basically a mix of those two feelings.
Pauline Gier reports for the BBC from Cameroon. Moving to healthcare and technology. In recent years, there's been a significant rise in funding for women-led health tech companies in Africa. Four women-led startups have been at the forefront of this innovation. Kasha, a digital retail platform for health products and household goods in Africa, is one of them. The company recently raised $21 million in investment. This is the largest ever made by a woman-founded health tech business on the continent. Kasha is led by Joanna Bishel, who started operations in Rwanda and now operates in Kenya, South Africa, Burundi, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Other countries are soon to follow. I've been talking to Joanna about how technology can help women get better health care.
With Kasha, we're actually aiming to disrupt the global health industry. We want to turn health supply chains upside down, make them customer-driven, data-driven, reaching the last mile and optimized for women. And so Kasha sells and delivers health products, household goods to the low-income mass market segment across Africa.
If you were explaining to a potential customer, person that you have in mind, what does Kasha do for her? What would you say?
Kasha enables her to order the health products she needs confidentially and discreetly delivered to where she is. There's many products that women need. Some of those are actually have a lot of social stigma, but with Kasha, she can order without anyone knowing what she's ordering, and it arrives in a very discreet packaging, even if she lives in a rural area.
What sort of products would those be?
We sell to a variety of different customers, whether those are pharmacies, hospital clinics, and consumers. And what we find with consumers, just in individual orders, usually they order what they're embarrassed to go into the pharmacy and the shops for. So for that, it's a lot of pregnancy tests, HIV self-test, emergency contraceptives. So we find that these direct-to-consumer models are best used to enable access over social stigma.
Now, in lots of countries, those exact products are actually available on the healthcare system via donors, for instance. I come from South Africa, and you can get condoms, and you can get contraceptive pills, you can get HIV tests for free. In this case, the people that you're talking about will pay for it, will they?
You know, actually, they are buying a lot of these products that they can get for free in subsidized through public clinics. But often, for example, with something like condoms, they don't like the quality of the free condoms. Or there's such long lines within these public sector clinics, and they see so many people within their community that they actually refer to order directly from private sector. They know the quality will be good. They know it will be in stock, and they know it will be more confidential and discreet.
You say that it will happen digitally, so somebody would request or order it online, right? How would it work? Explain to us.
So most of our customers, the consumer customers, individuals, they have a basic mobile phone, not a smartphone. They don't have easy access to internet. And so they use their basic phone to order. They dial a short code like in Rwanda, and that pops up a menu. And you don't need internet for that or a smartphone. And they can browse through menu items. They can pay with mobile money. And so it's like an e-commerce, but no pictures. And that goes directly into our systems. And then we're able to fulfill that order and deliver it to them.
And how do they find out about this? Because I'm struck by the language that you're using, they're consumers or customers. Now, in the public health system, people are called citizens and patients, etc. Yeah. So this is a very different relationship that we're discussing here.
For us, we very much believe that in the power of business. In business, as you serve your customers. So it is about providing value add to the customer, and the customer makes the decision on what to order and whether to come back, and you are responsible to add value. And I think that's the beauty of business. And for us, our entire customer segment is the lower income customer segment. It's a huge economic force.
But I'm wondering whether that particular relationship based on transaction serves the business side of things better than it does the customer. So how do you, for instance, know that the person requesting or buying a particular product needs the product or it's the right product for that person?
The fact that we have people who are lower income customer segment who are purchasing products, we make those products as affordable as we can and we make them accessible in their community. And they order from us and they order from us again. And I think that proves that there is a need for private sector to be able to provide these affordable quality medications. With Kasha as well, it's access to health information and not just the health products.
What I was wondering about is medications. How are you able to ensure that that is something that they can safely buy and it's something that they need?
We absolutely align with the policies of the Ministry of Health within the countries where we operate. So, for example, if it's a medication which requires a prescription, we do not deliver that product until we get the prescription, and we have pharmacists on staff that vet that prescription. If they don't have a prescription, we connect them to some telemedicine with doctors. It's in the same way as if you were to walk into a brick and mortar pharmacy. The only difference is, you know, we really centrally manage that.
Now, one of the reasons why we're talking to you about this, about Kasha, is because we've seen an increase in funding for women-led startups from 2 million in 2022 to 52 million in 2023. Your organization is one of those that has received very large investment. So what is the need that you're fulfilling? And you said earlier that you were disrupting the healthcare provision. What is it that you're disrupting?
Right now, global health, and that's really the way billions of people get their health medicine, is very broken. And most people, especially in the lower income customer segment, get their medication from the public sector. A lot of corporations don't think that there's much economic power within that low income segment. And what happens is, globally, there's a few people in a room that make a decision. There's very little data that is actually goes into that decision. And so I think what Kasha brings to this space is we're very tech-driven, very data-driven, but also very mass market focused, operating at very high volumes. And we're serving a need that's actually sustainable. So it's not just about aid and donations. It's actually a sustainable business that continues to grow and scale.
Why this interest by investors in women-led companies like yours? What's happening?
So when you look at just investment in startups globally, Africa gets only 1% of that capital that's available to startups. And of that 1%, less than 2% goes to female founder CEOs. And so the data is pretty shocking. Also, there's been a lot of data to show that women do grow strong businesses. Women tend to be, you know, very calculated in their growth strategies and deliver stronger results. And so I think there's interest in investors to prove this out. And if you look in the private sector industry, there's so many technologies that operate at scale that are much more optimized for individuals and a better experience, and especially around women. You know, there's always a lot of talk about women, you know, we should optimize for women, but there's very few solutions out there. And so as a woman, I do know what it's like. You know, it's difficult to approach and get certain medical products. Now, imagine if you're in a rural community, everyone knows everyone. And so there's opportunity to change that. It's technically possible, and there's best practices to deliver around the country. And so Kasha started really to show that there's a different way. This can work and it can operate at scale.
Joanna Bischel, CEO and founder of Kasha, a tech health provider. And by the way, the company is named after her daughter, who is called Kasha. Today's program was put together by Stefania Okereke, Bella Hassan, and Lola Schroyer. It was overseen by Sunita Nahar. Ricardo McCarthy was our technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service, celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.